Not to resort to trite musical theater references at the 11th hour, but I've been through Nixon, Reagan, two Bushes, and I'm still here.
Still queer as folk.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast, where each week we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show and find out if it still holds up 15 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
This is the season finale of season 3, so please give us a 5-star rating, a review, or a social media like wherever you happen to find us.
You can make sure you find us on Instagram and Twitter at StillQueerAF and on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk. We also have a website where you can leave us a message, either written or voicemail, to play on the air, and that's at StillQueerAsFolk.com/hello.
This episode is called The Election, though half of the episode had nothing to do with the election.
Absolutely nothing.
It's episode number 14 of season 3. And it's the season finale.
It first aired in the U.S. on June 22nd, 2003.
It was directed by Kelly Macon. This is the third of 11 episodes directed by Kelly, and I have a small correction to make. In two previous episodes of Still Queer as Folk, we referred to Kelly Macon as female. He is, in fact, male. Our apologies.
Whoops.
Small error in professional podcasting.
Yes. So for the third time, showrunners and executive producers Ron Cohen and Dan Lipman wrote both the story and teleplay for the season finale.
I always hate these when they write the teleplay and the story.
Although I'm sure when we get into it, there are things I wasn't not mad about in this episode.
Yeah, I think these episodes just end up being a slightly more preachy when Cohen and Lipman are doing all the writing.
I would definitely agree with that statement.
Here's what happened in The Election from Queer as Folk, the book, and Matt. This is the last time we will be quoting from Queer as Folk, the book. It ends at season 3. There was no season 4, season 5. It was just over.
Oh, boy. Liberty Avenue takes on a colorless existence under Stockwell's reign as Debbie continues to enlist voters.
Literally colorless. Yes. Brian sells off most of his possessions to pay for an anti-Stockwell TV ad campaign, and voter turnout in the Liberty Avenue precinct leads to Stockwell's downfall.
Melanie worries about miscarriage because of family history, but makes it through her first trimester.
Oh, that's right. She's pregnant.
Oh, yes.
She's got to take it easy, remember?
No more work for the woman.
Emmett refuses to go back to Ted, who hits rock bottom, and enters rehab, where he runs into Blake Wyzecki, one of his counselors.
Hunter's horrible mom shows up with the cops to take him away, forcing Michael to take the kid on the run, and stopping only to get Brian's last worldly possession, his car.
The election had the highest IMDb rating of the season, coming in at 9.0. 84% of people rating this episode gave it an 8, 9, or a 10. I didn't quite think it was that good. I thought it was right around a 7. Good solid 7.
I could guarantee you that the high rating comes from the somewhat happy ending of the Stockwell storyline.
Yeah, the ending was at once uplifting and at not once bizarre. So we'll be talking about that throughout this podcast. This episode actually was structured strangely, I will call it. It didn't really have A, B, or C stories. It really just had three acts and one runner. So we split it up into those acts. And the first act is Brian in the election. And we see that Pittsburgh has descended into a black and white shadow of its former self.
Yes, right at the moment that a gay couple is walking down the street and sees cops, they break apart, and then we are given a more black and white. At first, it was more sepia tone, but then turns into a black and white view.
The colors were draining.
Yes, from Liberty Avenue and from the episode.
It used to be such a magical kingdom full of sprites and fairies. Now it's like watching The Wizard of Oz in reverse. Cops in the streets, cops in the bars, cops in the clubs. It's fucking depressing. Unless you're into cops.
Now, I was 100% on board with this episode being in black and white. And I was like, you know what? I get it. I get the context of the metaphor you're going for. It lasted for one scene.
Two scenes. Came back at the end.
At the very end. Well, and see, here's my thing, though. I think the entire episode being that colorless existence, they should have committed to it. I would have much preferred everything happening in black and white until the very end.
It wasn't a very good black and white. I mean,
it was very flat.
Yeah, there's no contrast to it.
So yeah, it was jarring for me that then after this initial opening scene that it just went back to color.
I liked it at first, mostly because I've been exploring that private Dick film noir look in my non-podcasting photography mm-hmm. work. So as soon as it went black and white, I was like, whoa, okay, cool. And then I was like,
yeah, you would have thought the DP would have given it more dimension.
It was, yeah, and it was just kind of gimmicky. It's like, the life has been sucked out of Liberty Avenue. We know. You don't have to give us this big right. visual cue.
And again, that's why it would have been more okay if the entire episode had just been in black and white. Just commit to the whole thing instead of making it just like, we're going to make it a shtick for the opening scene. And then don't worry, we'll go back to the regular.
There's a quick reminder that this show is 15 years old when we see Brian unpackaging his $5,000 50-inch television.
Liquid television.
Liquid television.
Yes. Let's talk about dating the show in this moment.
And of course, the first thing to play on it would be Brian Stockwell commercials. What a coincidence.
Which... Justin literally says, he says that it's almost Dickensian, and it's like the show in this moment becomes self-aware and it recognizes like, yes, we know it's a coincidence. We're doing this all on purpose. And I feel this episode references itself as the show goes on, as the episode goes on.
Gay as Blazes.
Which is canceled.
Yeah, we found that out.
Yes, in the last episode. And so the show has become very self-referential in this episode. It's fascinating.
Well, somehow overnight, Brian managed to put together a complete counter ad.
On April 11th, 2002, Jason Kemp, age 19, was murdered. His body left in a dumpster. Less than a month after Jason Kemp's murder, Police Chief Stockwell suspends the investigation, citing lack of evidence. 5 days later, Chief Stockwell's former partner, Sergeant Kenneth Reichert, unexpectedly resigns from the force. 1 year later, DNA testing links Kenneth Reichert to Jason Kemp on the night he was murdered. The next day, Police Sergeant Kenneth Reichert commits suicide. Oh my God. Before you elect Jim Stockwell mayor, aren't there some questions you'd like answered? This political advertisement paid for by concerned citizens for the truth.
How did he put together this ad so quickly?
Well,
he doesn't have access anymore.
Do we remember when he edited that photo shoot for the...
he's done several.
The pool boy, yes.
And he did Michael's photo shoot, too.
Yes, he just did that on MS Paint.
Renaissance man.
Just give him a computer and he can change the world. But that ad, I thought was very lackluster. It was just stating facts.
I thought that ad was a little bit more in tune with modern political ads than the first music video of Stockwell playing basketball.
I would 100% agree with that.
Maybe that's all Brian can like do on his own without an entire team of people.
He can do some dissolves.
You're right.
Put some
scary music
posts up. Yeah. It was just funny to me that what we had seen leading up to the moment that this ad airs is a lot of voter apathy again, which Brian himself is totally guilty of. You know, we hear people say that, oh yeah, we think Stockwell's hot. I'd do him in a second.
I would.
Oh, absolutely. Don't get me wrong. I think we'd all jump Stockwell's bones.
Plays basketball after all. Come on. Mm. And racquetball.
And gets into hot tubs.
That's right. And steam rooms.
You know this guy is totally fucking at the Liberty Bath, or did at least. He fucked the priest. You know.
Maybe the gravel pit.
Yeah. But I was having trouble believing that particular ad could then capture the attention of the entire bar.
Well, that was funny too, where Brian just struts into the bar and commands the bartender to turn off the music and turn on the television. It's like, he's got power in that bar. Can you walk into any gay bar and do that? You just walk in and say, turn off the music. Put the TV on.
I have been drunk enough where I've gone into the booth at Sidetrack.
Turn it off.
And demanded certain music play.
Christina Aguilera.
There are a lot of, so I go a lot for Musical Mondays. Everyone knows I'm a theater artist and I love my musicals. So at Sidetrack on Mondays and Sundays and Fridays, they will do musical performances. I have a shit ton that they have never played. And I am at the ready. I'm like, here's all the tapes. This is what you need to start playing from now on. Some of my top favorites, you should really check out Lilias White, who sings Don't Rain on My Parade, puts Barbara to shame and recorded. You can quote me on that.
I ran into you there before on Musical Monday Night.
And yeah, I sang Into the Woods for you.
And it wasn't just that. You sang every single song.
I have a strong musical theater knowledge.
Yeah, I think all of them.
I try.
So Brian's counter ad got me thinking about Reichert's suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't the story have been better if Reichert died under mysterious circumstances, thusly putting a bigger shadow on Stockwell? Instead, it was part of the ad. 2 days later, Kenneth Reichert committed suicide. How about days later, he disappeared?
No, I think that that shows the mysterious nature of the action. The timeline of that is very questionable.
But a murder would have been a better cover-up. Like, Stockwell's covering up not one murder, but two murders. His partner killed Jason Kemp, and then Stockwell killed Kenneth Reichert.
I think that's where it would feel like reaching.
And then bullet holes were found in Ben and Michael's window where Hunter lives.
We got to remember that this is not Law and Order SVU, but this is Queer as Folk. So I think the suicide...
I love true crime drama.
I do too. I mean, Criminal Minds, anyone?
Yeah.
I think the suicide, though, allows for a little more grounded nature and feels less conspiracy theory.
It was a conspiracy,
at least compared to saying that he was also murdered. Jason Kemp's murderer was also murdered.
You know? 2 days later, he turned up dead. What is Stockwell hiding?
Right. But I think the suicide says that Reichert had no way out.
Yeah.
And he knew the writing was on the wall.
So Brian apparently has no access to ready cash, even after working at a high level in advertising for 10 years and has to sell all of his belongings.
Is he living paycheck to paycheck? What the fuck?
My rough calculations for Brian's garage sale indicate that he could have gotten pretty close to making up all the money that he spent on that ad. So he says that he spent $100,000 on it.
20 30-second spots.
His painting is by Attila Richard Lukacs, easily worth $50,000. Justin calls it the naked guy.
I'm sorry, art student Justin.
His Italian-made Moda sofas, at least $15,000. His Mies van der Rohe table, $3,000. His new liquid television, we already know, is $5,000. So that's $75,000 there alone. And he paid $100,000 for the spots. So he's not that destitute.
And he maxed out 5 gold cards.
Yeah, so he didn't even pay for it with cash. He's on a repayment schedule with interest, of course.
Which, and based on your math, sounds like he could easily pay off at least 4 of those cards.
Sure.
Done.
I did like his possession withdrawal symptoms, though. I thought that was a clever line. It was just a little kind of silly that he has to sell all of his belongings for a dramatic purpose.
He's left with nothing but this amazing loft apartment.
The nice thing is that come season 4, it has tremendously beautiful new furniture.
How quickly one turns around.
And Justin was barely in this episode, but he got some action after Brian sold all of his belongings. It's really the extent of Justin here.
That's kind of true. It's like, you have nothing but my ass. So here you go.
I would sell my naked guy painting for that.
For Justin's ass or any ass?
Justin's.
Okay.
Yeah. Or what did Brian call it a few times? A blonde boy ass or whatever.
Yes. This hole he uses.
So, wow. So Stockwell loses the election. Debbie leads the entire bar out into the streets. And the song True Faith by New Order is playing. That must have cost a fortune. That song is huge. And again, I just thought the black and white stuff was a little gimmicky. And there was one moment where a guy just runs across the screen with a blue flag. What does the blue flag mean? It was just a plain blue flag. Could have at least been the EU flag with stars on it or something.
Well, and let me just say that this is why I think the black and white thing would have been even more effective if it had lasted throughout the entire episode and not just the opening scene and the closing scene. I was very moved when the guy took the rainbow flag up on the Liberty Avenue post. I was literally almost, I was welling up. I felt it.
Yeah, I liked it. I liked this whole scene too, but that moment of raising the flag reminded me of that staged footage of the Russians hoisting the flag over the German Reichstag at the end of World War II. It was almost now, for like me, shot that's for a, shot, the same thing.
I feel like that's a deep cut. But okay, sure. I just found it a very triumphant moment amidst the darkness and reminded me of what I think a lot of us would have wanted to have happened in 2016 and hopefully what we will be doing in 2020.
Well, the dance party was kind of neat and it was cute. And it really made the scene for me was the song. That song by New Order, True Faith, has been in and out of my life since I was a little kid. And it always strikes me. That celebration actually reminded me of the day that the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed gay marriage in the U.S. And there's a spontaneous party in Boys Town, Chicago. People took over the streets. It wasn't black and white. Traffic was only shut down briefly. And it's worth noting here, though, that there are two living U.S. Supreme Court justices that voted against that. They're still on the bench. That's John Roberts and Clarence Thomas. And three, actually, and Samuel Alito. So,
and now we have two more who now have the majority.
Yes. These are trying times.
And this is why I thought it was really important and it really stuck with me that Vic said what he said.
Not to resort to trite musical theater references at the 11th hour, but I've been through Nixon, Reagan, two Bushes, and I'm still here.
Which, if you don't know, Patrick, is from the musical Follies.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. So Follies is a musical about the it's based on the Ziegfeld Follies. It's a Sondheim musical, and the song is sung at a particular point by the character Carlotta, who goes through what she's survived throughout her career. Different leaders, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, multiple husbands. But she's still here. And it's such a triumphant moment. And so I thought it was really wonderful that Vic slid that in.
We're going to need to make a list of all the musical theater one-liners that come up in the entire series.
There were some that I was surprised at, even after seeing this series and they revisited it. And I'm like, holy shit. like the biggest one was the Janet Vandegraaff one. That blew my mind.
Yeah. And you didn't know that one. Remember?
I
pulled that one out.
I was like, wait a minute, it's actually named after Janet Vandegraaff. That I was astonished by it.
That's one of our best show moments this year.
My jaw dropping.
Literally. So the election's over. Stockwell's voted out. We never hear from him again. His name's never mentioned.
Which I feel like
Gayopolis is saved.
By rage. And I feel like that's such an easy way, again, out of some massive storyline that they have built basically the entire season around. It would have been interesting to see what the complications would be if Stockwell had still won. Well, believe me, I'm all for the optimistic ending. Like, that makes me feel happier that he lost. But it would have been nice to see like one last hurrah from Brian looking at Stockwell as Stockwell walks away in defeat in some way. Or then again, maybe Stockwell, that's the point where Stockwell bends over and gets fucked by Brian.
Oh my God.
Right?
Wow.
I'm just saying. Maybe Stockwell's like,
what musical is that from?
Naked Boy Singing.
Oh, what is that boy's name from Skokie, Illinois?
He doesn't have a name. He's just a perky
little boy.
He's a perky little porn star from Skokie,
that's
Illinois.
That's it.
Still queer as folk.
Like what you hear? Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. We like those 5 stars.
It's Still Queer as Folk. There's more on the way. So Act 2, Ben, Michael, and Hunter. Do you remember quite a few episodes ago when I mentioned that Ben is very precarious on a bicycle?
Yes.
Here it was.
Everyone's on a bike. They even got Hunter one.
Yeah, a little BMX bike. Both Ben and Michael looked like they'd never ridden a bike before in their life.
Like, what is this contraption?
We also see that their apartment is on a new street. They've moved.
They must have picked up the building and moved it away from all the hustlers.
I think they lost their exterior. Hunter's mother appears at Ben and Michael's doorstep.
The principal's office at the high school gave me your address.
Is something wrong with Hunter?
Hunter? You mean Jimmy? Is that what he calls himself these days? I'm Rita Montgomery. I'm his mom.
So by all means, come in and have coffee.
Yes, because she says she got their address from the school.
Yeah, well, why? They invite her in.
And they invite her in.
I'm having some coffee.
Like, listen. First of all, I would have a discussion with that school saying,
yeah, why
how did you validate that this was his mother?
Right.
Second of all, how dare you give away private information of a student if you don't know?
Third of all, 100%. He's not even our kid. We're not even the
Everything
guardian.
About this doesn't make sense.
There was something about Rita Montgomery that was just immediately very off-putting. I disliked her right away.
She seemed very, almost too put together. You know, she was trying very, very hard to be accommodating and saying like, oh, I don't know where he gets these crazy ideas.
Well, yeah, that was it. I picked up on the crazy in her right away.
I was like, yeah, no, just suspicious. One look,
it's like, woof. It's like those people that you cross like the street.
There's something about you I don't like.
Or you're on the subway and somebody's talking to you like that and you're just like, okay.
I'm going to keep walking.
Right. Next car. This scene was shot really nicely for the subject material. The camera was alternating clockwise and anti-clockwise in circles around the table, depending on who was talking. Well, it really captured how off balance her appearance was putting Ben and Michael, which is something that I really liked in the cinematography there. Just the camera kept moving around the table, and then whoever was talking, the good party and the bad party, it would reverse. I didn't really like Debbie's line to Ben and Michael in the bar.
I understand, sweetheart, and you've done a lot for that kid, but she's still his mother. As much as you and Ben care about him, nothing can replace a mother's love.
She was pretty much telling them to just give up on Hunter because that's his mother. Full stop. It's like, Debbie.
That's a strong position to take because she knew what Hunter's position was before Michael and Ben took him in. And she had no way of possibly questioning what his mother was like. She's just going to take the mother at the word, especially because she's never met the person.
Yeah, I feel like those lines were really more geared towards Michael. Like, Michael, look how we are. It's like, how can you do that to this little boy?
I'm sorry, but like Debbie is clearly on the other side of the world from this woman.
Totally. I did notice that in the bar that neither Michael nor Ben were drinking alcohol at the bar.
Aw.
Ben had a Pepsi and Michael had a Perrier.
They're cleansing right now?
Well, it just makes me wonder if that was a conscious prop choice or not. After what they had just found out about Hunter's mother, they deserve a drink. Right?
They also probably still wanted to be clear-headed. Thinking about what to do. And I'm sure alcohol would not have helped their decision.
Yeah. I think it might have been a small turning point in the show where the characters don't soak themselves when bad news comes around.
Yes. They don't go to it for comfort. They don't go to substances for comfort. And it shows like that there's going to be a sort of turning point in the maturity, especially for Michael, which I thought was fascinating.
Later, when Ben and Michael are at home, Michael is watching the movie His Girl Friday from 1940. And the synopsis of that movie is, a newspaper editor uses every trick in the book to keep his ace reporter ex-wife from remarrying.
Yes, that's Katharine Hepburn, yes.
Well, what was the significance of that movie here?
I think it was only significant because of the action that happens.
Just they had good police cuts and chase clips and yes, stuff like that.
Because it was like they were saying jailbreak as Hunter is bursting out of the.
That was quite a bit of effort to find a movie that would have those clips.
His Girl Friday is a rather classic Hepburn and Gary. Oh my gosh, I am blanking on
it. It's Cary Grant, isn't it?
Cary Grant. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, Grant Hepburn film. It was sort of their screwball comedy.
I love the screwball comedies.
Yeah, that's kind of what it was. And so to have that moment to very obviously reflect the moment where Hunter is being told that his mother has come to find him and he bolts for the door.
Hunter, your mom was here.
Fuck! How did she find me?
Well, the school gave her our address. She came to see us and...
Shit!
Hey, well, hey!
Colonel Williams, just escaped.
Yeah, right. Don't know yet.
On your back.
Williams, get the power!
Hey, Cody! I think it was a little on the nose to comment on he's running away.
Yeah, ran down the brand new street that they live on, even though it's the same apartment.
It's even under construction.
Yeah.
So it is a brand new street.
There's something interesting here when Michael and Ben were talking to Hunter. They seem to be taking Rita Montgomery's word as truth.
What are you doing?
What's it look like? Getting as far away from here and her as I can?
Listen to me. She said she feels terrible about giving you away.
She's a liar. Don't believe a fucking word.
What about you? You're the one who said she was in jail for killing your father.
Excuse me. She only stabbed him.
She wants to make it up to you. Why don't you just talk to her? Give her a chance.
I'll never go with her.
Okay, take it easy. Take it easy.
Don't get off me.
Yes.
I would have thought that Ben, at least, being the wise Buddhist, would want to hear Hunter's side first. I don't know. They just seem to be saying, well, she is your mother and you need to speak with her and she wants you to go home.
Because, yeah, they're making it seem like she was so convincing in their meeting with her.
Yeah, but then they do a complete U-turn out on the street.
Because I think because Hunter was absolutely convincing. It just didn't feel like his usual bullshit.
Well, maybe not, but I'm not sure which story was the truth here. They just didn't really cleanly line up. Apparently Rita Montgomery somehow abandoned Hunter to the foster system. Then Hunter escaped from it. Then he became a street walking prostitute. So when did Rita herself teach him this, you like young dick pitch? You got to pull your weight, Jimmy.
So there's Hunter's mother's version of the events, which is, I wasn't able to take care of him at the time because I needed to get away from my husband. So I put him in the foster care system. He ran away from the home that we put him in after I tried to find him. And I'm so happy I found him. Then there's Hunter's version of the story, which is Hunter's mother attacked his father. She stabbed him and therefore left them with no provider because he left. So she said that Hunter had to pull his weight and so made him hustle for money.
And then after he went to the foster home. This doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, this is the confusing thing. So are we to assume that maybe while he was hustling, that's when he got picked up and taken away?
Well, yeah, because how does a mother just deposit their child at this like permanent daycare center called foster home?
Like law, like accountant, there's also foster home.
I mean, he was like 14, 15 at that time.
Yeah, so it's not like it was a newborn infant.
So maybe Hunter was right. Maybe she did run into legal troubles. And because she was going to be incarcerated, he became a ward of the state at the foster home, mm-hmm. escaped the foster home, learned how to be a hooker.
Well, then he also had told Ben and Michael about abuse with his foster family. So
kid's been through a lot.
Yeah, he absolutely has.
Later, Rita pops back up on the street. She's just like kind of skulking up and down Ben and Michael's street. It was so creepy when Rita and Hunter came face to face with each other.
Ugh.
Ben and Michael had an interesting approach to keeping the 16-year-old Hunter. They basically kidnapped him.
Well, I'm his mother, and I don't see where you get a say. No, I say get your stuff together. We're leaving.
I'm sorry, but after what he told us, he's not going anywhere.
What did he say? More of your stories?
Which makes me wonder why they weren't already going down the legal path, because after all, they became de facto guardians of him.
But and guess what? They know a lawyer.
That's right.
Like, as soon as they have that interaction, I mean, it could have been as something as simple as saying, Hunter has revealed something to us that makes us feel uncomfortable about you taking him, and given what he has had to do.
They just said, we've decided he's going to stay with us.
Yeah, I mean, like, no. I'd call
the police, too.
Yeah, I agree that that's not how this works, but I would feel like they would need to say, like, in order for his safety, we feel that it is necessary that we get our attorney.
Well, I don't know why they weren't doing this all along, because
exactly,
because this has been a couple months at least that
especially
been under their care. What if he needed emergency surgery and needed parental approval or something?
Well,
Uncle Ben.
They were just riding on that assumption that she was in jail for murdering his dad. So they figured, well, she's in jail. What the fuck does it matter anyway? No one's looking for him.
This seems really naive on Ben and Michael's part.
Oh, I think it is. I think they should have said, listen, if we're going to take in this hustler, we need to figure out what are the legal repercussions of this. Oh,
yeah, maybe not right at first, but after he moved in and after they're feeding him, supporting him, sending him to school
and given their address as his home, it only makes sense that maybe we should talk to an attorney and talk about what it means, at least for legal guardianship or something like that. Because what if Hunter had to end up in the hospital again? Are they going to just buy the uncle excuse again? Like,
yeah, at some point you got to prove it, right?
Yes.
So the police appear. Chaos ensues in the apartment. And I just love it when Ben says nonsense like, everyone try to stay calm.
Michael,
he always does that.
Michael seemed so shocked that she actually called the police. Yeah. Of course she fucking called the police. Yeah. What do you think she was going to do? What?
Everybody stay calm. So Michael and Hunter skip out the back door, find Brian at the celebration, take skis and hit the road. The end.
Now, okay, I don't want to skip over that moment where Hunter went and hugged Ben.
Yeah.
That was actually a very sweet, beautiful moment. Just in the nick of time, too, because you can hear the cops coming up the stairs. And then I went and I was like, I'm sorry. I know you're taking Hunter away to get away.
Kidnapping.
And you just kind of leave Ben there to deal with the cops and the mother?
You take the heat.
Thanks, Ben. Run away.
Yeah. Do you think Ben the Buddhist would be able to lie to the police? Like, no, I don't know where Michael is. I haven't seen Hunter. Don't know.
Yeah, it could have.
Can't find him.
That's true. I mean, well, an easy
thing
is like.
Didn't come home from the comic store.
It could have been something as simple as like, Michael is out there looking for Hunter. Hunter bolted out the door and we have been out there trying to find him since we had this altercation with his mother.
Yeah. Well, the police might say, okay, well, wait.
Sure. And be like, listen, we don't know. And then Michael could have tried to like, something. We don't know where he is. I thought they were. When Michael went out with Hunter to the street celebration to find Brian and get his car, I thought they were somehow going to like underground railroad him to Brian to like get him away in some way.
Yeah, Vic pops up and says, I know a guy.
Exactly. Because Vic is really great for that.
That's right.
And the guy he knows is like Rodney. Like Rodney somehow knows.
Turns into like the Great Escape.
Oh, it'd be amazing. Which also, side note, I'm really glad to see Rodney was there celebrating with Vic.
Oh, yeah. He did have a little appearance there.
Still queer as folk.
Still queer as folk. There's more on the way. So we have a listener question this week, and it's not a voicemail. It's a written question. It's from Andrea, and I'll read it for Andrea. I am a straight female. Oh, wait, this is Andrea speaking. And Queer as Folk is one of my favorite TV shows. I was introduced to it by my gay male best friend. My question is, do you have any female friends who enjoy the show or that you've tried to introduce the show to? And also, how do you feel about the fact that there are so many straight female fans of the show?
Well, Andrea, I have to tell you that I was introduced to Queer as Folk by my female friends in college.
Yeah, me too.
And one of those female friends included my girlfriend at the time. We were freshmen watching in their dorm room, and it was a fascinating experience. But yeah, I feel like there are a lot of, at least female, I don't want to speak for everyone's sexuality, but there are definitely a lot of female fans of this show, as I can see from a lot of our discussions that we have on our Facebook page, as well as those who are more dedicated listeners who join in on our conversations on Facebook. And I think that really speaks to the more universal nature of the show. And I think the fact that the drama and the intriguing characters really allow the show to break out of what would have been a much more niche market, at least in the early 2000s, and reach a broader audience even today.
At the time that the show was airing, gays hated it. They really felt that a lot of the subject material was not representative of the entire gay community. And that's a kind of a common thing with the gay community is anything that comes out that's even remotely gay, everyone feels that it has to have something for everybody in it.
Yeah, that's why the show included a very direct reference with Gay as Blazes. And mm-hmm. we saw how people were either really attracted to the drama of the show, or they thought, oh, that's not realistic at all. It's like, aha, we see what you did there. And it's the same thing that the show experienced in being a sort of queer as folk for today. And it didn't have the same kind of more explicit experience that people were looking for that they saw in Queer as Folk, which I strongly disagree with. But
yeah, I think every gay guy has a whole ton of female friends. They're a little bit of the spirit guides for gay males. And so watching the show together was always something that I did when I was watching the show. And I think quite a few other people do. Most of the gay bars that Matt and I go to, I think the makeup is generally pretty evenly split.
Yeah, it's usually about 50-50.
Yeah. Maybe back during the era that the writers were out and about, it might have been somewhat different. So Cohen and Lippman at the time they were writing the show were in their 50s. So maybe back in the 80s, it was a little bit different where it was a lot more clicky. But I've got tons of female friends. They've all seen the show. They love the show. And I would say that females love the show more than males do at this point. I love that Gail Harold.
Yes. And I also wonder if, and this is just me personal opinion, that a lot of the way that some straight men are real fans of lesbian porn, I think a lot of female fans tend to be a lot of fans of more male-on-male action.
I'm a fan of that.
Well, I'm a fan of that as well. I think there is something to be said for that as well.
So thanks for your question, Andrea. I appreciate it. If you'd like to leave us a question that we can either play on the air or read on the air for you, you can visit us at stillqueerasfolk.com/hello.
Still Queer as Folk.
Now the exciting part of this episode, which is Ted and Emmett. I found this first glimpse of Emmett talking to Lindsay to be a little strange.
Emmett? Sweetie, you can tell me it's none of my business and to butt out. But if Ted wants to destroy himself, that's his choice. Don't let him destroy you, too.
Lindsay, sweetie, it's none of your business. So butt out.
These are close friends. He's living there. They know each other inside and out. Doesn't that give the Dykes some kind of purchase to get involved with Emmett's problems with Ted? But well, instead sort of it's like a butt out.
They're sort of already involved by allowing Emmett, who is apparently homeless, to stay there. And it made me question,
what are they butting out of? You know?
Well, Lindsay made the comment saying that, and she even offered, like, you have the right to say it is none of my business and to butt out. However, let me state my opinion on the situation. He did immediately apologize and say, yeah, you know, he is.
Lindsay, I love you. Butt out.
But, and then he did apologize. Then he actually said, I'm sorry. And, you know, he was acknowledging that they are putting
sort of
him
like,
up.
Fuck off. I'm sorry.
I'm really sorry, but sorry, really fucked fuck all off. The way off. And then it made me wonder, like, did he in fact blow all of his money on Ted paying Mel and Lindsay back? Because, like, he's still booking parties because we hear him have a conversation with Vic about meeting with clients. So, like, he couldn't even find some studio to
well,
rent.
I think this is like a day or two later, right? Because there was Hunter's birthday party where Melanie says, you can stay with us. So I think this is still like in the weekend leading up to election day. So
okay, then that timeline is definitely not clear.
I don't think he's had
then.
Time to find a place yet.
Well, part of me is thinking that he hasn't really been looking. I think he's been wallowing a little.
Yeah.
That's where the timeline for me is a little muddled.
There was some nice staging when Emmett was starting to snap out of it, and then Ted just shows up at Mel and Lindsay's front door, complete with the overexposed, washed-out look that is following Ted around.
much like the first moments of this episode, he is also completely drained of color because of all
really
of the pipes
shot.
He's hitting.
Yeah. There was a really interesting moment where he comes through the entryway, and there's a shot of Emmett, and you see Ted in the mirror, walking past the mirror. Before you actually see Ted emerge into the shot for Emmett to be confronted by him is a nice little subtle piece of blocking. I'm glad that they left that mirror there for that. There was something about this scene that caught my attention though. We see glimmers of the old Ted when he first gets there and he's awkwardly joking with Emmett about living with the Dykes.
Michael told me you were here. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, Mel and I kissed and made up. Well, we didn't actually kiss.
Then life with the lesbians isn't as horrifying as one might expect.
That's the really, really tough part about dealing with an addict, because quite often they remind you of who they used to be.
There's still glimmers of them because they're in that in-between where they're not high, but they're not in withdrawal.
And it's just very confusing when you want that person to be part of your life again, but they've gone through such a radical change, but you still see these little things. They say like certain words, or they smile a certain way, or they make the same joke. That's a little bit of the insidiousness of living with and dealing with an addict, is you just kind of keep getting pulled back into it because you see what you used to be in love with.
And that's something that Ted could even pull on. That was a tactic for him when he kisses Emmett. To remind him.
And yeah, I know. Said he wanted him back like hardcore here. He was like pretty happy with his Tina friends.
Yeah, and as soon as Emmett gave a rejection, Ted turned into that sniveling addict, and he was blaming Mel for turning Emmett against him. And it's like, no, and I love that Emmett says, no one turned me against you except you.
Well, someone's been talking to you. They turned you against me, didn't they?
No. Teddy, no one turned me against you, except you. I hope you'll get some help.
I don't need any help, okay? And I don't need you telling me what the fuck to do.
There's something else that was interesting about the scene. They haven't exactly broken up. It was never all that official, really. He kicked him out of the house, but he didn't have this official "we're finished" moment.
Yes, and Ted even says that when he's trying to make up with him. He says, "I'm your friend. I'm your lover."
Lover. Love that word.
I mean, so he used to love that word.
Yeah. I hate that word, by the way. Remember?
Lover.
There's a great move by Brian at Babylon later that night when he takes Emmett out on the dance floor.
I loved this interaction. At first, it was Brian trying to be sarcastic. Emmett shut it down quickly. And Brian...
Oh, I didn't think he was being sarcastic. I thought it was a really good... I called it the keep dancing lecture from Brian.
Oh, I'm talking about like that specifically where he says, it's the Widow Schmidt.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he says, could you spare me the wit? And Brian, contrary to other moments that we've seen him, managed to subtly change his tactic of trying to cheer Emmett up. Usually he goes for the extreme.
He rescued him here.
Yeah, but here he gets him on the dance floor feeling good again. But we see that Ted is there as well with Dr.
That's why he did it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the only reason he did it. And I absolutely love it when my friends do something like that for me.
Like, hi, I'm going to rescue you from this moment right now. And I thought this was so smart on Brian's part and that he was still able to give very hard truths to Emmett. But it's a very strong point that Emmett, you could be pulled into this just as easily. And I think that Emmett has already shown a very acute awareness that the drugs are dangerous. Yet he was willing to give in to Ted, and he did the drugs once to try and make Ted happy.
Something that was striking about Ted's thing here is that everyone is deserting him. And I've been a big proponent of that in the last few podcasts. You know, Ted made his bed. He's got a lie in it. But there was never this group intervention step where the entire cast of the show, Hunter included, comes together.
To say, Ted, you need help.
Yeah. And I thought that was weird. I thought that people abandoned him very quickly without trying to do at least one Hail Mary on it.
I think that was sort of the step we skipped.
Yeah, I would have liked
in
to
this storyline. And that it's an excellent point that the help can only work for Ted if he's willing to receive the help. But we never saw really that opportunity of them saying, like, of all of them together. And we get Emmett saying it, but we don't really get anybody else saying, you need help, Ted. And this is how it has affected all of us.
Yeah. Even in The Sopranos, they did an intervention on Christopher. Mm-hmm. They ended up beating him up at the end, but they tried, you know, it's all the mobsters
at least
circled around him trying to do an intervention, and all the shit coming out of his mouth just enrages them all until they beat him up. It was a really good scene. Another really good moment here was the way that Dr. Mark the Devil led Ted out of Babylon. Mm-hmm. It was so creepy because Ted was a zombie being led away by this evil guy. It looked so creepy.
And it was so smart to show every time they cut from Emmett and the camera slid over to where Ted was to give us that view that Ted is clearly on drugs. It's a great way to show that they had given us a visual cue of when Ted is clearly high.
Yeah, and I love that difference between the atmosphere. Of course, when we see these images of Ted, all the color is drained out. There's all this like tunnel vision and everything's like very muted. And then when we see Emmett just dancing up a storm, putting Brian to shame, by the way. it's like bright, it's beautiful, there's confetti. I like that dichotomy between the two. It's really nice.
It was much more full of life.
Totally. Absolutely. So here's a scene that I thought could have been the season finale cliffhanger. I think that the entire season could have just come to an end with this scene at Ted coming to at Dr. Mark's place after a 3-day binge. This was like the most gripping part of the entire episode. And I felt like it just wrapped itself up and Ted marches off into rehab. They could have like really hung on this one and left people wondering what was
like
going on.
And I think the gangbang reveal is one of...
Let's not ever have to say that again.
I know.
Gangbang reveal.
Was one of the toughest moments in the series for me. Because it played like a horror film.
It started out with a kind of awkwardly funny vibe. When he comes kind of like...
stumbling out.
Yeah.
And like there's still like sexual...
There's like weird music going on that kind of had like a funny uplifting vibe, and the camera was attached to him. So we get some interesting cinematography.
He sees that everyone is watching this video and he's like, oh, looks hot.
Everyone. Yeah. There were like a lot of meth heads
all, this party. There's a lot of meth heads at this
all
place.
Of Pittsburgh was there.
All the Pittsburgh meth heads were there smoking and laughing and watching this guy get it. And the second, I kid you not, when that camera managed to pan down and show that it was Ted getting fucked, that was just terrifying.
I remember watching it for the first time, and I remember not seeing that coming.
Really?
Yeah. It was not predictable the first time that I saw it.
And the fact that in the video, he is in such a state, like his eyes are literally rolled back in the back of his head and not in a good way. Like he is gone.
And it's cut back and forth with Dr. Mark on the sofa in his traditional satanic look, kind of
grinning menacingly.
Yeah. Like the puppet master of it all. So that's enough to get Ted into rehab. He didn't waste any time going there. When Blake Wiesecki first appeared, the colors were all muted and flat, and I wasn't sure if Ted was hallucinating.
Yes, because he even makes a point, because like, last time I saw you, I left you here.
Yeah, so I like the confusion that it gave me as the viewer in watching it. It was a good storytelling device for Blake to be the counselor, but as a healthcare professional, and as somebody that had a previously... As somebody that had a previous relationship with him,
yes.
He would have been obligated to immediately disclose that he's a counselor there.
And somehow say, I can't be the counselor for this person.
Yeah.
I did drugs while with
I
this
almost
person.
Killed him.
I put him in a coma.
Right. So it's a good storytelling device. I liked it. I liked that he came back, but this was one of those improbable possibilities.
Yes, that for drama's sake, Blake is now your counselor.
That aside, the writing here was good. It was useful to see Ted start to act like a protector to Blake for a couple instances before he reveals himself as the counselor. It, again, is some of those glimmers of the addict, pre-addict that I liked. And I like seeing Ted in that kind of fatherly figure. Like, because remember, he tried to fix Blake so many times. And then we see Blake there. He kind of starts going back into that, but then pulls it all the way back when Blake says, I'm your counselor.
The look on Ted's face, I was having trouble reading. Is that embarrassment? Is that shock? Is that...
I think it was everything.
It was everything.
And that's why I thought Scott Wohl did a great face act there, because he just put every piece of the last three seasons into it. Every single thing that we know about Ted, everything that we know that he went through with Blake the first time came out in his look like, what?
Yes, he's now out at sea, it seems.
There's only one runner in this episode, and that's Melanie and Lindsay. And this was a very super minor part. They did have a great sex scene, though.
Yeah, did you find Lindsay's obsession with the pregnant Mel a little fetishy?
No, because I just looked at it more clinically. I'm not looking at the lesbians and their sex scene as...
Well, because she was talking about how like she loves how sexy she looks pregnant. And then as they're having this sex scene, she goes like, you know what I really want to do? I want to rub your belly. And I was like...
Well, there's great music, though, that went along with it. That was a song called Sweet Sweet 69 by the Comas. And that was a good musical choice by McFadden and Perlmutter, the music supervisors. Melanie rips the needle off that song, though, when she sees the blanket, when she's going for the sticky lube.
Now, I will say, I think the blanket discussion, I thought was a wonderfully tender, quiet moment of revealing between partners. But I still feel that at some point, now that they've already had a child and we know that Melanie knew the possibility of a difficult pregnancy was entirely possible, that they never talked about the fact that her mother had lost a child.
Right. This came out of nowhere.
Because I feel like that's such an easy thing to say, like, you never told me. It's like, you all seem to like not talk to each other at all.
Well, in this case, too, it's Melanie is always opportunistically Jewish. Where yes. Where it makes sense for the story is she becomes Jewish. But other than that, it's never really part of them, except for season one, episode two, No Bris.
The Bris.
No Bris, yeah. No shirt, no service. That was clearly Jewish.
Oh, absolutely.
But then there's just not that much. There's Yiddish words
sprinkled after that, they
in.
Never really talk about it. They never, I don't think we even get to see them like celebrate Hanukkah or acknowledge any other Jewish traditions other than the bris, right. And this thing about buying
gifts before a trimester. But then I wonder if she's
real, but
yeah. But again, the fact that she had never revealed such a thing when she's about to go through her own pregnancy.
Right. It's like, what? let's have a stand up this morning before we get started on this pregnancy thing. And here's some things that are important to me as a Jewish woman.
Dot, 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 dot.
Yeah. It's like she died. And, you know, it's like, as Jews, we don't do baby showers. We don't buy before the baby.
But also,
let
as her partner.
Let me teach you about my ethnicity.
But also, after multiple years of being her partner, none of this was talked about.
Right. Well, the story fit. And that's kind of where it ends. She gets through her first trimester.
And they get to celebrate out in the street.
It's a new order. Okay, let's do hits and misses for this episode. What's your hit, Matt?
Oh, my hit is Vic's volley reference. I'm still here. And I was very proud of it. And I get excited every time I see Rodney, because then that tells me that Vic is getting it still. So good for him.
My hit was, of course, the use of True Faith by New Order for a full 8 minutes in the closing act. And that song has always been a favorite of mine. And then it's enough to pull me through the kind of gimmicky black and white to color, run with your flags, raise your banner type of symbolism.
It's very Les Miserables.
Yeah, 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 totally. So what was your miss?
My miss was Michael kidnapping Hunter. You're just making things worse. What are you thinking?
You got to risk everything.
You should have got, as soon as Michael saw the way his mother looked at him, he's like, we need to get Melanie here now. And that would have been the way for them to handle it. And Mel would have been there ready to deal with the cops and saying, like, this is what we believe.
Or she can get an emergency injunction, restraining order.
Or something.
She can do law.
This, yes. We need you to law the situation.
Law, Melanie. Let's go on to my miss for this episode. I felt that the use of these weird quotes in the episode were overdone. Risk it all. Mourn the losses. Celebrate the victories. Stuff like that. It's like when Cohen and Littman write the entire episode, we tend to get these sort of predictable older man gay psalms.
Here's the hi. If you, in case you haven't picked up, this is the message of the episode.
Yeah, they just always ring hollow for me when the characters are just doing their best to slog through them, because all of a sudden they're breaking out of being a 30-year-old to being like your 70-year-old grandfather giving you wisdom. And you're just kind of like, what? This has been episode 14 of season 3, The Election.
And this concludes season 3 of Queer as Folk.
We will be back for a special episode recapping season 3 and also playing some Queer as Folk trivia games. Ooh. So don't miss it.
We're on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF, and you can find us on Facebook to continue the discussion at StillQueerAsFolk.
Find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall, and I would love to connect with each and every one of you.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at MatthewPD with 2 T's.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed your time with us this entire season, or just this episode, or just a few minutes, please give us a positive review or a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. So until next time, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me. Still, Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.
Still Queer as Folk.